Where we begin. Are this week's Parsha of Vayera, and it's got, you know, jam-packed with goodies. We got Avram, the three messengers, angels, men, the come and appear, and we're going to deal with the Avram hears about stone and the negotiation for stone. That's what we're going to focus on for today. And you got, among other things, you got the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. This is one of the most action-packed parshiot you're going to get. We have class. This, by the way, this is our fifth cycle. I think Suzanne's been us for all five. Congratulations, Suzanne. Otherwise, no, it's keeping me honest. I can't recycle. So we got that going on. All right, so we're gonna start off with a video clip, as is our way. And we'll get into some conversations, and we'll take it on. Okay, we'll share screen action. All right, so this is from the 2000 movie, 28 Days, now an old movie, Sandra Bullock. Here we go.
Oh God, it's Saturday. We're late for my sister's wedding.
Gwen knew how to get a party started.
Don't worry, I'll replace it.
She just didn't know.
Cake store.
When to stop.
Your sentence was for 28 days of rehab or jail time.
We carry our own bags here. This isn't the Sheridan.
Stop! Everyone, this is Gwen.
I'm thinking booze.
Painkillers.
I have to pick just one.
So what's the deal here? People actually get stiff?
You know, if your counselor catches you using, you can get kicked out of here.
I don't plan on discussing it with him.
Too late.
This place is horrible. It is miles away from anywhere. People chant.
How did you feel?
Okay,
just a good start. It's a good start.
It's really sort of helped me stay sober off and on.
This could be your liver right now.
Do you have plans for dinner?
You ever heard of deviated spectrum?
It ulcerated the septum. Lean on me. I'm not like those people out there. I can control myself. I can. If I wanted to, I could. If that's what I wanted, I could. I can!
Columbia Pictures presents...
My name's Gwen. I'm an alcoholic.
Sandra Bullock.
Don't let them tell you there's something wrong with you. You're fine.
I don't feel fine.
Of course you don't feel fine. You're in deliverance country surrounded by a bunch of sober freaks.
In the story of a woman...
I don't need your help.
There's not what your neck sign says.
And the first 28 days...
If I'm gonna do this, everything has to be different.
Of the rest of her life. 28 days.
I hope he makes it.
Statistically, it's good for us if he goes back to using. Odds-wise.
All right. You able to hear that, everybody?
For the most part, it's a little scratchy.
Okay. All right, so let's get into the share. Okay. All right, so just as you saw from the video clip, after stealing a limousine and crashing into a house while drunk, Gwen, played by Sandra Bullock, a big city newspaper columnist, is forced to enter a drug and alcohol rehab center. She considers it a complete waste of time, and she thinks people there are a bunch of losers. So Gwen awaits the completion of her 1 month confinement so she can continue her party lifestyle. And slowly she comes to realize that she indeed does have a problem and begins embracing and caring for those around her. Okay, so why is Gwen initially resistant to going and engaging in a rehab program? For those who are familiar with people who have addictions, well, this is a very obvious point.
She didn't think she had a problem.
Suzanne, I can't hear you. Speak up.
Can you hear me now a little better?
Oh, yeah, a little better, yeah.
I think it's my head. She didn't think she had a problem.
Right. And that's basically the feature of an addict. They think they're controlling their consumption of the alcohol, of the drugs, of whatever it is, and they don't realize that they're being controlled by it. And that's really one of the main goals of the rehab, where you get to the point where you have to be able to get to the point. If you're taking a 12-step methodology, you get to the point is you'll say, "I'm Joe, and I'm an alcoholic," where you admit that you are the person with the problem. All right. All right, that's quite why she thinks she doesn't have a problem. Okay, good. What type of personality defects are difficult to change?
The ones that are causing you to be addicted to something?
True. I mean, you could argue all of them. The answer is all.
I didn't hear what you said. What was that?
You could argue that every personal defect is difficult to change. Now, why is it difficult to change? Personal defect.
Because you like some of the bad things initially, right?
Of course. Most people will like the way they are, or the way they are allows them to immediately solve the problem or imagine the problem or solve it. Okay?
It usually doesn't really come to light until, like, what happened with her, with the accident, like something bad happens to her or people around her or them.
Right. Now it's interesting. Initially, even though that she was drunk at her sister's wedding, she knocked over her sister's wedding cake and she embarrassed her sister in countless ways at her own wedding. Okay. Okay. She didn't accept that she had a problem, even when she's at the, a number of days into the thing. And then she herself tries to get drugs, and then she's caught, and she's going to be thrown into jail. And then she's, like, really going through withdrawal. Then she starts to wake up to the fact that she is, she's a disaster. And then she starts open to, and then she's confronted with her family members. And she starts to become cognizant of the amount of hurt that she has inflicted on others, then she starts to make the move. Okay, what principles of living life did she lack and ultimately gain?
I mean, from the trailer and from your blurb about the summary above, it seems like she embraced not being self-absorbed and trying to empathize with others.
That's true, but that's really a result. In other words, what people are addicts, drug addicts. She was both a drug and alcohol addict. What's a fundamental cause? What are fundamental causes?
They have no coping skills.
Right, so they're overwhelmed. So this becomes a self-medication. In other words, drinking and pills become a self-medicating of emotional problems. So she can't stand, she deals with certain problems. It's not a problem. You take a pill and the problem goes away. Until you become sober again, take another pill. And then there's a collateral damage. So she starts to recognize that the tremendous damage to herself personally and to everybody in your family, everybody she loves. And she starts gaining the skills necessary to, deal with problems sober. So in what sense is she a different person?
Broken the cycle of addiction.
Okay, but what makes her different then? She was a person who was formerly an addict. Why is that a different person?
Because she's confronted her issues regarding her addiction?
That's step one. Like in the Tshuva process, we call that Hakara Sakhe, recognizing the sin, but that's not really Tshuva.
So she examined herself and made changes.
What kind of changes?
I think it could be argued that
she's
two different
people.
Say again? Emily?
I think it could be argued that she was two different people, one personality and one person when she was taking the drugs and a different person when she was not taking them. And so if she's not taking them anymore, she's more of her true self and she's able to see more clearly who she is as a person and what she believes.
Correct. In other words, when she's an addict, she is one kind of personality whose methods of dealing with pain or stress or issues is one thing. She examined herself and through, you know, medical help, able to gain new principles of action, new strategies, new skills to deal with the problem without having to go into drinking and drugs as methodology. So literally, to put on, I'll use a couple of metaphors. If you imagine her as a computer, she has installed the next version of operating system. She has new ways to run her life, new principles of interacting. So therefore, she has a new experience, i.e., let's say a new program. She can run that smoothly. Using a different metaphor, she's different because her thoughts, her feelings, and her actions are completely other. And that is the totality of a person. That's the essence of the person. Their thoughts and their resulting feelings and actions, that's the totality of the person. So if those things change, she's literally a different person. Now, this is all introduction. Let's go into a Pirkei Avot, one of the classic Pirkei Avot. All right, somebody want to read it out? All right, man, we'll read.
Hu haya omer, ein bur yirechet, v'lo am ha'aretz chasid, v'lo ha'bayshon lamed, v'lo ha... Can you move your... V'lo ha'kapdan melamed, v'lo kol ha'marbe, bischora machkim. V'makom she'en anashim, ishtad eli yozish.
I translate? I'll read the
Hill used to say, a boor cannot fear sin, nor can an unlearned person be biased. A bashful person cannot learn, nor can an impatient one teach. Those who are involved excessively in business will not become a scholar. In a place where there are no men, endeavor to be a man.
Okay, let's unpack this. Okay, so first of all, I'm going to just read the Rambam gives a basic commentary, which, and then we'll put this all together to try to explain it. Let me have Emily. Can you read it on the screen?
Yeah.
Rambam's commentary. Take it up from there.
Okay. A burr is one who does not have wisdom nor proper traits, and an ignorant person, literally a man of the land, am ha'aretz, is one who does not have intellectual virtues, but he would have some character virtues. And the meaning of a person prone to being ashamed is known. And an impatient person is one who is impatient about everything and gets angry. And the matter of striving is to accustom your soul and lead it to acquire the virtues. And since there are no wise men there to teach you, you should teach yourself.
Okay, let me break this down. So the Hillel, the famous Hillel, speaks of he introduced you to a number of people, okay? The first guy is called the boor, okay? Okay. What is a boor? What does the Rambam tell you what a boor is? What's a boor?
One who does not have wisdom.
Or proper traits. Okay, so he breaks it down to two things. One is what he calls wisdom. Those are like, knowledge and principles. Knowledge, principles, and strategies. He's not it. In other words, what you would call in our day and life, not educated, and doesn't have proper traits. The second quality is that he's completely unrefined. He's purely instinctual. You know what I mean? He was not brought up in a family that taught him how to be civil, be restrained in any kind of way, purely instinctual person, okay? All of us have met such people, okay? Right? In other words, purely instinctual, does not have any kind of personal qualities. In other words, personal, we call it Hebrew midot, or character traits. In other words, things that they have worked on. In other words, they don't have any way to control their anger, their lust, their, you know, any feeling they have. They're just a sort of a ball of emotions, okay? And on top of that, they don't have, they're not trained in any discipline or any skill. So they're an unskilled, typically in the ancient world, they'd be an unskilled laborer. And it would probably be like a schlepper guy, a guy who would carry stuff. And doesn't have any character traits. So he'll be rude, he'll be aggressive. He's just whatever his emotion is, that's what he is. All right? Then the next guy, so that guy, Ein Bor Yirei Chet, the Hillel says, this guy cannot fear sin. Why is that?
Because somebody who understands what sin is understands that there's right and wrong, or truth and false. And if the person who's entirely a ball of emotion, he's not thinking about that at all. He's just acting in the way of his emotion.
He can't argue. Sin is an abstraction. But there's a right path and a wrong path. So this guy doesn't have the internal mechanism to guide themselves. It's just like, however they feel, that's what they do. No impulse control. Therefore, not only do they not avoid sin, they can't have a reverence toward avoiding it because they simply, you know, they don't have boundaries, they don't have control, except for the most, in other words, there's a difference between not sinning and having a fear of sin, a concern about the sin. In other words, yeah, they might not shoot somebody because they don't want to end up in jail, you know what I'm saying? But they don't have a concern about the damage a sin or a sinful life can do for them because they're not operating on that level. They're, you know, using modern psychological terms, they are a unactualized person in the highest degree. Okay, well, get to, so that's person number one. We're going to person number two. Amar, it's literally a man, a man of the land. What does he have? What does he not have? He's better than the boor. What does he got?
Some self-control, but he's ignorant.
Well, he doesn't, in other words, he has self-control. In other words, let's say like a person who was brought up in a good family, right? So they're taught about how to be generous, how to be kind, how to be compassionate, how to be, you know, on time for work. They know they have all the life skills to be, you know, what you would call the Amaretz is your perfect neighbor. He's thoughtful, he's considerate. Now he doesn't have intellectual virtues. Again, the problem is the English the Hebrew does not translate well. Intellectual virtue means he does not have in other words, he has a series of axiomatic, let's call it beliefs, or you call cherished notions, okay? You know what I'm saying? In other words, he lives his life, you know, honesty is the best policy. Somebody gives you something, you should try to be, you should reciprocate. In other words, they have all these sort of like, their life is filled with aphorisms and how they should operate, but they don't have any idea why that's good or not, but they can operate in a new situation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's exactly what I was just going to say. He's reading he knows all of the quotes from Buddhism and stuff. You know, that's what he knows.
Not just like that, in other words, not that he has, I'm just saying that the way that this person, an Amart person, they live a disciplined life. You know what I'm saying? They're good people. But they don't really have a sophistication of thought of why this is or is not the good life. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
This is really, the truth is, this is most people. A college-educated person, you know, they, you know, they know about how to be, you know, they have a basic, they know how to be strategic and effective in a work environment. They know how to be a good neighbor, even a good citizen. But abstract principles about, you know, we're talking about here, about philosophical principles, they're not really aware of them at all. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or what Socrates would say, they live pretty much an unexamined life. You know, what is justice? What is kindness? What is compassion? What is the life worth living? What is a meaningful life? They just, their manner is mostly habit. But they have good habits. You know what I'm saying? Or you want this guy as your neighbor. You ask him for you ask this guy for a lawnmower 100 times, what is he going to do?
Give it to you.
He's going to lend it to you, of course. Oh, that's what a good neighbor does. Yeah. What to think about? I'm trying to depict it. Now Hillel comes out with a bomb statement. He says, Lo Amar is Chassid. The Amar can't be. A Chassid is like a very righteous person. Now, why is that? Is he doing all the right actions? Let's say this guy's a Jew. Is he keeping kosher?
Yes.
Maybe.
Yes. Is he keeping Shabbat? We're talking about an Amar who's an Orthodox Jew. I'm making it. Is he keeping kosher? Shabbat.
Yeah.
He's doing all that. But what would be the quality of that phenomena?
He doesn't understand the meaning behind it.
Right. He doesn't really know why he's doing it. He's just doing it very carefully. Right?
He's unexamined?
In other words, he keeps Shabbos every week.
Right.
But if you push them, let's say a person who was not observant sat down at his table and start to ask them some basic questions. Like, why do you keep kosher? Why do you keep Shabbat? Why are you observing altogether? What would be his fundamental answer to all of those questions?
Because I grew up that way?
Right, tradition. With Fiddler on the Roof, tradition.
Right.
And they might point out that, you know, on top of that, it builds good, you know, he might begin thinking, like, well, it also builds a tremendously good, strong community, which is true. But it's as far as any of the sort of the why, he's going to be very weak. And therefore, Hillel says, this guy can't be truly righteous because he can do right actions, but he really doesn't know why he's doing it. Why is he doing the right good actions? Because he was raised properly.
It's his minimum. Parents.
Now, they themselves could be Ameha'art. They also could be ignorant. In other words, they could be accomplished professionals, but, you know, what's their principle? Well, of course, you should be educated. You should go to college. You should get a job. You know what I'm saying? But why? Why is it important? They can't really, let's say, make the case, if it will. You know what I'm saying? Beyond the practical realm. Is that personality clear to you? Can you see that guy or girl? The Amaretz person?
Yeah.
I think it's clear.
Okay, good. Let's go on. Now, so the Ram is now the Hills then goes, now he seems to not see something that doesn't fit in. Below how Baishan Lomate and the shy person or bashful person does not learn. Why not? Why will the shy person not learn? Now, this is an opportunity for you guys not to be shy.
Because they're afraid to ask questions?
Yeah, why?
Because they're afraid that they'll embarrass themselves?
Right. In other words, that for them, their preserving of their sense of dignity and esteem and social identity is far more important than getting the concept clear. You know what I'm saying? They don't want to sacrifice their sense of dignity by asking the teacher, to explain that concept one more time. They don't want to look for simply like they're dumb. Now, I'm not saying it's admitted to look dumb, you know what I'm saying? But to be, you know, you don't have to necessarily do it in class, but go to the teacher after class if you want to avoid. But I'm saying the person, because of their shyness, avoids, you know, questioning and asking. So the mitzvah really is the teacher's there to teach, you know, and even if, and the teacher in Jewish law, interesting thing, if the student asks 100 times, you got to answer them 100 times.
That's the next personality.
Now this guy, the next guy, is the law kapta malamed, and the impatient guy, he's not, he should not teach. Why is that? I mean, kind of obvious.
Because on the 99th time of that, of being, of having to answer the same question, he's going to get annoyed.
The ninth time, the second time.
Second, okay.
Right, so basically what he's going to do is, he, because of his anger, angry guy, impatient guy, he's going to make everybody in the class completely all shy because they don't want to endure being yelled at. So he's a terrible guy to teach. He can be a very wise person, but he doesn't have the quality of patience to be able to repeat things or say something in different words. To be a teacher, you got to be, you have, if you're, you know, if you're a teacher, you're there for the student. If the student, and if you've got to try to get a lesson through, you got to find creative ways to be able to communicate the concept. Now, obviously, you want to have a lesson that's appropriate for the class. But if it is appropriate, you got to review it again. You know what I mean? So the Baishin is hurting themselves. Their missing principle is, in other words, they're not the boor, they're not the amart. They have some intellectual concepts, but they're like nervous about being, you know, insofar as preserving their social status. Let's call it, in order to preserve their brand, they're quiet. And then they lose because concepts don't become clear. And then, and the lesson goes on. Either they get lost or whatever, or they're missing from fundamental elements, and the edifice, which is their, the building, which of their knowledge, is become very shaky. Okay. Then the hill continues. Local marbur b'schora makim. Not everybody who increases in business will become wise. Why is that? What is about being overly involved in business result in not being wise?
I mean, I wonder if it's because, or one of the reasons is, it's because you see everything as purely transactional.
No, he's a good student of Torah, right?
Uh-huh.
But he's spending a lot of time in business. What's his, notice, this is a, Hill has basically given you the ingredient list of how to become wise. So the boor is not, has not gone through a process of awakening to become a new person, because they don't have qualities of discipline, of their self-control, of the basic drives, okay? Or they don't have training of any principles. The Amharic has the principles of the discipline, has basic life skills, has professional, in other words, has lots of skills, right? How to be a good neighbor, how to be a good business person, right? Does not have the higher concepts of ideas of the why of anything. They're very good at the what of life. They're very weak on the why of life, okay? Then we got a guy who could be a great person who is developing their not only do they have the what of life, they're working on their why, but they shut themselves down because they're trying to preserve their brand. They're quiet, they're shy, they're timid, they don't ask. Then there's the opposite of that is the teacher who is impatient. Well, that's the guy who basically effectively what? Makes everybody in the class shy because he's so aggressive and angry. So he's a bad match. We call Marv Viscora. The next case is guy's basically, he could have all these other good qualities, but he's getting distracted in basically becoming a workaholic. You know what I'm saying? And he's just not giving terror study in this case, the proper amount of due time. He's just lost at work all the time. Then we have the famous statement of Hillel, in a place where there's no men, now the Rambam says, to teach you, ishtarlios ish. You have to become your own person, your own man. You have to become self-taught. In other words, you can't say, well, there's nobody here to teach me. There's a mandate that a person can't be passive. Or you can't say, well, you know, Rabbi Rosenthal, teach me. In other words, that's good, but you have to be an active person in striving to acquire the qualities, both in personal character traits and various ideas. You know what I mean? You can't be a passive person. Person just sitting there absorbing. I'm not saying to talk all the time. You know, do you understand that point? In other words, there's the message that really Hillel is talking about. What are the ingredients to nurture the soul into a creative soul that is trying to seek understanding and awareness and discovery? And he's identifying all the different personalities that have challenges to that. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And the last one is there's nobody there to teach me. Well, I'm, you know, fine.
And is Hillel saying that this is actually just another one of the personalities on the list?
Yeah.
Okay.
And a call to action. If you're in a situation, or whether you're a passive guy, you're not active and you're not striving to enhance your soul.
Right.
Okay. That's one problem. But and then one manifestation, well, there's nobody to give a class. Well, I'm not going to, you know, I won't do anything.
Right.
In other words, the person is only activated when they're in front of the teacher, and they're activated only but in a passive way, versus taking on the personal mission of discovery themselves. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So you got to grab the bull by the horns. Now, I bring all this as an introduction to one of the most amazing episodes you're going to find in the Torah, where you have Avram arguing with God. Well, let's get into it.
Right.
It's a wild, wild thing. All right, Sean, read it out.
All right. Avraham negotiating with Hashem. The strangers got up from their places and gazed at Sodom. Avraham went with them to send them on their way. Hashem said, shall I hide from Avraham what I am going to do? Avraham is about to become a great and mighty nation, and through him all the nations of the world will be blessed. I've given him special attention so that he will command his children and his household after him, and they will keep Hashem's way, doing charity and justice. Hashem will then bring about for Avraham everything he promised.
Sean, stop 1 second. So you have a very strange thing that... So the scenarios, there are three men. They told Avram and Sarah they're going to have a child a year from then. Of course, we have the story of Avram doing this amazing amount of hospitality, running to get stuff. According to the Midrash, he just, not only that, he was on the third day of his after circumcision, so he was in deep personal pain. Okay, but, all right. And then they're going up, and then we have God functioning as a narrator. God said, shall I hide from Avraham what I'm going to do? Like, again, who is he talking? One thing he's talking to, quote unquote, him as a narrator, but God as narrator. You know what I'm saying? And he's saying, God is about to become a great man, or he's speaking to the angel, maybe, according to the one possibility. So why is God about to share with Avraham what he's going to do to stone, to the evil city of Sodom and Gomorrah? Or Hebrew is Sodom and Amorah.
Your question is, why is God sharing that with him?
Yeah, he's giving, before he introduces him, God is speaking to us, the audience. imagine a play. The narrator, i.e. God, goes to the front of the stage. The pin light is on him, right? And he says, shall I hide from Avram what I'm going to do? Avram is about to become a great and mighty nation, and through him all nations of the world will be blessed. I have given him special attention so he will commit, so that he will command his children, his household after him, they do their keep God's way, doing charity and justice. God will then bring about for Avram everything he promised. What's going on with that? Why is God speaking, quote unquote, to us or to himself, but as narrator?
It seems like this is a test for Abraham.
Why do you say that?
To see whether he can deal with Sodom and Amorah in a different way than utter destruction.
Okay, so you're saying, so when I say, should I hide from Abraham what I'm going to do, you're arguing is...
I'm arguing that this is actually a test for Abraham. This must have been what, considering who Abraham was up to this point, for him to see Sodom and Amorah and their, you know, twisted ways, is this a situation where Abraham is going to say, well, yeah, I mean, what can we do? You know, destroy it and rebuild it or something, or, you know... Is there anything about what's going on here that is salvageable in some way?
Okay. Anybody else want to comment?
I think it gives a deeper meaning to it. So if somebody's going to narrate their thought process, I think it shows that they had multiple options. They didn't have to tell. They didn't not have to tell. But here's the reasoning for it, and it gives more meaning that way.
Correct. So the reason that God is going to reveal, quote unquote, his divine plan to Abram is because he says Abram is about to become a great mighty nation. And through him, all the nations of the world will be blessed. What about who Abram will become and does to his children by teaching them God's way and doing justice and charity and justice? What is that? Why does that, shall we say, tip the scales in order for God to sort of include him in the divine plan of what he's going to do to Sodom and Amorah?
Well, I don't understand what the answer to the question was. Can you go back and repeat that? Because I don't get it.
In other words, the fact that shall I hide from Abram what I'm about to going to do, Emily pointed out that he's acting in a rhetorical phrase. One possibility is that God could have elected not to tell him. And just, you know, Abram would have woke up one day, looked over the ridge, and the place that was before called Sodom and Gomorrah is now a big hole. Okay? That could have happened. Possibility number one. Possibility number two, he's going to tell him about that. And as you're suggesting, you're calling it, it's a test. Right? That's your argument. What I'm asking is that, but with the reason that he's going to reveal is hinging upon who Abram is and will become. So in your own words, what is Avram and what will he become? And we've used a phrase about this before. Who is Avram and who is he going to become, and why should God include him in his divine plan?
I guess from what I've learned, I would think that Abraham is sort of kind of a symbol of justice and kindness in the world.
Is the focus on Abraham as an individual?
No.
What's his focus upon? This is the key element, guys.
His leadership.
Say that again?
His leadership.
Ah, he's a leader. Leader of whom?
The Jewish people.
Only? It says on verse 18:18, Abram is about to become great in my nation, and through him all the nations of the world will be blessed. So in a certain sense, Abram, as he's called later in the Parsha, Av Hamon Goyim, a father of the multitude of nations. What we call in more contemporary ways, Avram is the father of civilization. And what is the what are the elements of his leadership?
Charity and justice.
Was stuck up in Mishpat. And the free afraid forward is God's way, Derech Hashem. So it has three components. Derech Hashem, also stuck with Mishpat. He teaches his descendants to do the way of God, the Derech Hashem. Lasso stuck with Mishpat, to do with justice and righteousness. So because the hallmark of Avram's leadership in passing on the way of God is what? Stuck with Mishpat. So Hashem is going to give him essentially what? What is about to happen? In one, what really is he about to give him in one word? What five-letter English word is Hashem about to give him? Hashem's going to give him a class.
He's going to give him a what?
A class. Or a lesson. Lesson on what?
How to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah?
No.
How to not destroy him?
Well, yeah, ultimately, Sodom and Gomorrah does do get destroyed.
But it doesn't destroy him, though.
No, it doesn't destroy Avram, of course not. But because Avram's not guilty. But he teaches them the lessons about the divine punishment, you know, the issues of justice and punishment. You know what I'm saying? He's entering him into this conversation. Something very dramatic happens. So let's go to 8:20. Sean, continue on. Verse 20 in chapter 18.
Hashem then said, "The outcry against Sodom is so great, and their sin is so very grave. I will descend and see. Have they done everything implied by the outcry that is coming before me? If not, I will know." The men turned from where they were and headed towards Sodom. Avraham was still standing before Hashem. He came forward and said, "Will you actually wipe out the innocent together with the guilty?"
I'll stop right there. So Avram, in his, when God tells him that he's going to go down to check out, but basically he tells him that there might be a complete what? Wiping out of, as we know, the Sodom and Gomorrah, the two major towns and the three satellite communities, okay? Total of five cities, okay? So what does Avram challenge God with? What is Avram questioning him on?
Literally, if he's going to wipe out everybody, or if there's a separation between the innocent and the guilty.
Right. So, he's inferring from what God says that he's going to wipe everybody out. He says, "Will you wipe out the innocent together with the guilty?" We call that collective punishment. Are you going to engage in basically? Are you going to where you're going to wipe out the guilty with the innocent? Let's go on. Now Avram's second statement. Go on. Verse 24.
Which verse?
24.
Suppose there are 50 innocent people in the city. Would you still destroy it and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 good people inside it? It would be sacrilege even to ascribe such an act to you, to kill the innocent with the guilty, letting the righteous and the wicked fare alike. It would be sacrilege to ascribe this to you. Shall the whole world's judge not act justly?
Can I stop right there? What is surprising about Avram's statement and declaration?
He's pushing back against Hashem.
Yes, and pushing back. That's, you know, he's being rather Now what's the problem with that?
It's a questioning Hashem's judgment, or knowledge.
Right, and if God is knowledge is perfect, so obviously God knows what he's doing. So what do you, so what is Avram even saying?
He knows now, better?
Like what? Right. No. Right. Now, so by what virtue is Avram even saying this?
Well, I guess presumably he knows somebody there who's who he thinks is innocent.
Well, he didn't say one guy. Well, I know my nephew Lot's there. Now, and only that, he doesn't know for sure. He, what kind of question is he asking?
He's asking if he's going to act justly. So here he's acknowledging like the power of God to be the ultimate judge, and he's challenging, is he not going to act justly? And it, maybe that relates previously to where Abraham is told he's leading the people in doing charity and justice, and now here is this the ultimate act of just or unjust.
Right, so he's been so so he is correct. He is identified as the person who God doesn't tell Abram at introduction of why he just comes to him and speaks to him, but he communicates with him. But Abram is the paragon of teaching justice. Now here he says, so basically, based on what God, what is this whole, Avram is basically saying, you know, you are the judge of the world. I don't understand this because this seems to be what? Unjust to wipe out the righteous with the innocent, the righteous with the guilty. Which of course, but as Sean said, well, how could you, that seems to be an irrational act. Well, if God is in fact just, if he's doing it, therefore it's just. What are you asking the question for? So what move do you have to make here? Why is Avram able to make this charge? What do you guys say? Why is Avram able to make this charge against God? You say it's all rational. The bottom line is that if God's doing it, it's by definition just.
I mean, is he encompassing all of the traits of the type of learner or teacher that we just talked about, and that he's not ashamed to ask a question, and he's also going to ask the question if no one else is there to ask the question?
So he is the quintessential example of, he is not the shy person. You can't get more bold than this, but I would say there's an additional point here. The point being is that, yes, he's asking a bold question. But we know from the context that God, quote unquote, has invited him in to a conversation. Because he says before, oh, should I what? Hide from what I'm going to do? So he's, in a certain sense, Abram infers from the circumstance that he's telling him, and that he's going to look into it. He's going to be involved in the investigation. That, so therefore, he sends an opening for a conversation about the justice of it. Because from his perspective, it would seem to be what? The height of injustice to wipe away the righteous and the guilty and make no distinction between the two. Basically be involved in what we call, collective punishment. Now he also gives it, but he also sneaks in another, and he also makes another argument. He sneaks in another argument there. What other reason should there be a reason for compassion? If there are 50, he gives really two reasons for 50. If there are 50 guys, 50 righteous people or good people in the towns, why should there be, why should they be acquitted? For two reasons.
Well, the one is that there's at least one person who is who's righteous.
Well, he's not. He doesn't talk about it. He doesn't mention there's one. He goes right to 50.
Okay, so there's 50
people.
Let us say,
suppose there are. Would you destroy it for 50 people? So one thing he's saying that if there's 50 people, he's really arguing that's a measurement of what? Of the goodness of the city, that they can produce 50 people, right? And in verse 25, would be sacrilege even to scribes and act to you to kill innocent with the guilty, letting the righteous and the wicked fare alike. So, you know, also the fact that the innocent could have what? Have influence. The good people could have influence on the bad people. You know what I'm saying?
So that's the collective punishment.
Now, one thing is that it's not right to just wipe everybody out. If you can say, these people are bad, there are 50 people, we're going to rescue them, we're going to get them out, and we're going to condemn the rest of the city. That here, the way that Abram first hears the presentation from God, I will descend and see if there's anything implied by Abram that's come to me. If not, I will know. Implies that it goes down, and if they've done everything, what's going to happen? They're going to wipe everybody out. That's why he says, well, one second. You're going to wipe out the innocent with the guilty? Let's say they're 50. You still destroy it because they're still, they're not spared for the sake of the 50 people, which means that, because these people are going to do what? They could be influencers for the good. They can move everybody to a better place.
So that's a collective punishment that you were talking about, right?
No. Verse 23 is the argument of collective punishment. Will you wipe out the innocent together with the guilty? That's one argument. Second argument is, suppose there are 50 innocent people in the city, would you still destroy, not spare it, but for the sake of the 50 people? In other words, because there are 50 people, they're worthy of being saved. Not collective punishment, because these people can be what? Positive influencers. Then he goes back to his original argument. It would be a sacrilege even to act like this, to kill the innocent with the guilty. You know what I'm saying? Okay. So we all familiar with the answer. Let's go ahead. Let's Scott, read it out. Verse 26.
26. God said, if I find 50 innocent people in Sodom, I will spare the entire area for their sake. Okay. 27.
Right, So Abram asked, and he gets a good answer. Says, you're right. I won't do it. All right, keep on going.
Abraham spoke up and said, I have already said too many before my Lord.
Too much before my Lord.
I am mere dust and ashes. But suppose that there are 5 missing from the 50 innocent. Will you destroy the entire city because of the 5? I will not destroy if I find 45 there, replied God.
Okay, so Abram says, look, so it's interesting. What's the radical shift of Abram's perspective from verse 25 to verse 27?
He's worried that he might not find the full 50.
No, but how is he presenting himself before God?
Trying to negotiate.
Well, he is negotiating, but what is he, but you see his stance is different.
He's worried, he's scared.
Well, he's not, look carefully, verse 27, look carefully, what is Abram's point there?
Now he's ashamed.
He feels that he's done what?
He's overstepped. He's no longer, he's out of place to make such a comment.
Right. In other words, relative to the Creator, I'm dust and ash. I'm basically insignificant. I'm basically inanimate objects. I can't get into this whole thing. Now, but it's funny, he doesn't say that I'm going to shut up. He says, but suppose there are 5 missing of the 50 and you got 45. Will you destroy it for the 45? And God says, I won't do it. And then Abram persists and said, well, how about this 40? I won't destroy it because it's 40. And then he says, then he pushes it. Let my Lord be angry, but I must speak up. What if there are 30 there? Because more, then God says, I will not act if I find 30 there. I've already spoken too much now before my Lord, but what if 20 are found there? God says, I will not destroy for the sake of 20. But basically, each level, we're going to see this far now, each level indicates another concept. Let my Lord not become angry, but I'll speak just once more. Suppose 10 are found there. And then God replies, I will not destroy for the sake of 10. So when he finished speaking with Avram, God left him, and Avram returned home.
So is that the lowest he went?
Yes.
Is that why we need 10 men for a minion?
Well, that's an interesting question. So Rashi argues that he knew that when there was less than 10 by the flood, when there were eight people in Noah's party, he just rescued them. So he didn't go, he knew that 8 or less than 10. So 10 apparently is the lowest entity of significant group. So when you have a minion, that's the basic sample size of, I'll call, what is a minion? The minion is sort of the smallest representation of like a Congress. It represents the 435 members of Congress and the 100 senators represent all of America, 330 million people. They are the voice of the people. A minion represents the Jewish people. 10, that unit of 10 is the basic unit. Less than that is now a collection of individuals. Okay, so let's take a look through the Sforno, how he understands this dialogue. We did a little ourselves. All right, Emily, you want us to read?
Sure. Abraham felt that the way God had worded the decree with the word Kirabat, that what God might have meant was that as long as the majority of the people were guilty, this would justify eliminating the entire city, including the innocent. In that event, God would not be perceived as meeting out justice.
Right. So stop right there. So they're basically so the Sforno is giving a play by play. So his question implies he inferred, and we discussed it ourselves, that if God saw that the majority of people were guilty, he's going to wipe everybody out, even if it's like 49% innocent. Which is a logical possibility. How do you identify the nature of this? At what point does a town become wicked? Well, you'd say when the majority is wicked. So that's 51%. 49% are going to be wiped out. That's it. So then as the Sforno points out, you're going to wipe away the righteous with the wicked. So what's happening here is that God had sort of got him into this conversation and sort of allowed him to ask him questions about the justice. As we said before, he's the quintessential opposite of the Baishan, the timid. He's being bold. He's a good example. Go on.
Even though you are justified in destroying the wicked on account of the righteous, far be it from you to kill the righteous. Subject to chance being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right, so I'm going to do the Hebrew with it. Bahayah kitzadik rasha. It'll come out that a righteous, and this is the question, this is, of course, the classic question in general, is why do bad things happen to good people? But if you do this thing, it's going to work out that there's no difference between the tzaddik and the rasha, subject to being chance. So what's happening? So you're a good guy, but you happen to be in stone, and you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and you can get whacked. And that would be unjust. All right, go on.
What's the first word in Hebrew?
Hashofei kol aretz, the judge of the world.
Seeing that you are the judge of the whole earth, if you will judge based on the conduct of the majority, you will eventually be forced to destroy mankind, seeing that most people everywhere are wicked.
Okay, so the Sforno is so So according to the Sforno, he makes, he interprets Avram's question to God is rather powerful. It says, since you're the judge of everything, and if you're going to use that methodology, go by, let's call it majority. If the majority are wicked, it's it, game over. What are you not going to have?
Mankind.
You're not going to have mankind. So that can't be. So that can't be the principle. All right, go on.
Seeing that, now that I will examine them individually, having sent my angels, if I find 50 righteous men of the type that will protest and try to stop the wickedness of the remainder of the people in Sodom, the leading city of the valley, I will save everyone.
Right.
Yeah, I will save everyone, not only the righteous people alone.
So he says that's the rationale. What's the idea of the 50? Because what are those 50 people? Those 50 people will be workers toward the good, who can be people of influence. You know what I'm saying? So 50 is like what is 50? What's the significance of the number 50? You have five towns. As a way the Sforno is understanding God's response to Avram's point? What is the significance of the number 50? Why is God good with the number 50? What do you guys say, guys? So 50 is, first of all, you could say 50 is a significant group. That's a large significant body. They can be sort of like in politics, there's a ruling majority and you have a vocal minority, and sometimes the vocal minority can influence the leading majority, right? Rashi takes it a little differently, that you have 50 people, 10 guys per city. They can be like sort of like squads of goodness that they could influence people. So you can look at it differently, but basically God says you have, if you got the seeds of what he called what? People who can make a difference and change, then what quality of, how will God act to all of the people? What's the one word?
Mercifully.
Mercifully. All right, so now, is it justice or is it mercy?
No, it's mercy.
Mercy, because really, based upon the thing, the wicked people should be killed. Because of the righteous people and their possible potential influence, they could be saved. All right, go on.
To ask questions concerning doubts in my mind regarding divine justice.
Right, so I'm just going to, I should translate the Hebrew. I apologize. He named now halted the bear. And behold, now I'm beginning to speak. Go on, read English.
To ask questions concerning doubts in my mind regarding divine justice.
All right, so the Sforno basically tells you right there that once Avram saw the doors open to like ask God, this is called the ask God anything about divine justice. And he says, like, I'm Anochi off of Ephraim, I'm just what? Dust and ash. Go on.
Seeing that I am but dust and ash, I have not been able to think the subject through to its logical conclusion. I depend on your answer.
Right. All right, so he says, "Hatashkit b'chamishai kol yir." Let's say you're missing five in every town. Go on.
Let me know if it is a definite rule of your justice, of your system of justice, that unless there is a minimum of 10 righteous people in any one town, you will destroy all these cities on account of the five missing righteous men. Each city is only 9 each. If you were to do this, the result would be that all five cities will. Can you scroll up a little?
Yeah.
Will be wiped out on account of five missing people.
Right. So he says that doesn't seem to be fair, because you're right. If I miss five, so I'm not going to have, you required specifically 10 per town. So if I'm missing five, then I got 9 per town. So really, everybody, so they're going to lose it all because they're missing this one, these five people. They're so close. You know what I'm saying? In other words, is having a unit of 10, like, you know, for the minion, the minion of goodness in every camp. If I don't have that, I'm missing one guy, you know, wipe everybody out. So so God responds, Vayomer, he says, Lo Ashkita, I will not destroy. I will not destroy all five. Lo Ashkita, I will not do any harm to all these three cities or guilt are less filthy than stone. Okay, so he goes into the various 20 to 30. I just want to, I'm running out of time here. But the point here is like this. I want to sum it all up. I want to put it all into a package here. There are times in the Torah where God gets into, sort of allows Avram and others and Moshe to engage in pushing back and asking questions about it. For example, in last week's Parsha, God says, don't be afraid, Avram. Your reward is great. And then Avram says, well, what good is my reward when I am what? When I am childless, how am I going to, you know, how am I going to, and the person who's going to inherit me is this Eliezer guy. You know, I'm not going to be able to have the whole promise of a great nation doesn't seem to be happening. I'm 85 years old and I've got a kid. So here you see questions him. And he also says, how will I know that I'll inherit? So there are times that Avram senses that he's now entered into God's classroom. And when he gets that opportunity, what does he do? He goes hard, he goes strong. And here he also does the same thing. God tells him, I'm thinking about destroying Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, one second, let's say there are 50 guys. Would you destroy it there? Well, then you go 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. And each statement is a possible formulation of divine justice. God is sort of revealing his secrets to Avram. And as we learned before, why? Because he has a responsibility. He's going to be the father of the Jewish people and by extension, the father of civilization and need to be armed with this wisdom. So basically, this is it. Obviously, we're not Avram, we're not Moshe, we're not these people, but we are. Each and every one of us have a responsibility to be the best students we can be. And what quality of a student is being brought out in this Chumash passage? And which, of course, Pirkei Avos passage. What is that? If you're in the class, what must you do?
Participate.
Ask.
You must ask till you get it clear. Now, the class that God gave Avram is the most exalted class called, we're now going to have a class called On Divine Justice. Well, Avram took that opportunity to the max. Interesting little comment, Nachmanides Ramban says, this conversation, we're just getting sort of like an executive summary. You know, it's like 5-8 cents. It literally lasted hours. So there was a lot of back and forth going on. So what we have here of 10 sentences is really sort of a summary. We don't know the full extent of what God revealed to Avram. Now, at the end of the Parsha, God tells him, take your son up to the mountain and sacrifice him. Now, that's a shocking thing. He just says, well, Yitzhak's going to be my child. Then you're going to kill him? What's going to happen to the covenant? And then he says, don't touch him, you know? So now why a circumstance is an opportunity for questioning, why that wasn't a class, why that was just a pure command, he had to submit to that, is, you know, it's not 100% clear to me. But what is clear is when you have an opportunity, certainly if you have a class with God, that's awesome. But in any learning situation, you have to be able to have the commitment that my really comes down to the following statement. I love my soul. And I want it to have the best understanding it can have. Even if it means that I might look foolish. even if it means I have to get out of my safe space, even if it means that I have to push myself to do my own research as well. And that's a very important concept. That really, you know, and that's what Hill is trying to tell us. You know what I mean? There are different levels of, you know, different levels on the human experience. There's the boor, there's the amaretz, and there's various kinds of wise people. But even if you're a wise person who's learning different things, there are things that you could stumble along the way. One is being shy, overly timid. And we saw the Avraham Avinu is like bold. He's going in there. A shofikol arts liyasa mishal, will the judge of the universe not do justice? Now, he's not doing this to be a rude person. It, just that the paradox that God presented there, that basically, the way that at least the Sforno, I'll give you one, there are different debates about that, but the way the Sforno presents it says, he understood God to say that if the majority of those towns are wicked, they're no longer worthy of existence. But then it's going to come out that, yeah, 49% of the people who are good people, they're going to be collateral damage. That doesn't seem to be right. And he points out further, and if you're going to do that, you're really saying goodbye to humanity, because you're not going to have the majority of humanity, I guess, in every circumstance to be good. So that's an interesting conversation about divine justice, collective punishment, fascinating topic. But the quality, the nida, the character trait to take away from Avraham is that I'll put it down to two words, the whole class of two words: fierce learner. You need to be a fierce learner. Not timid, not wimpy, not shy, not bashful. Fierce learner. Now, when there's a class, but when there's not a class, it doesn't mean that you're just, you know, going crazy. So, but when it comes to learning, you need to be fierce, not shy. Fierce, not bashful. Because that's how a person grows. And you know, I would say in America in general, our way that we learn things oftentimes on, you know, being passed on screens. You know, like right now. So the deck is against us, because we're not used to, you know, assertive, aggressive interactions. But that's really, you know, at the right place, at the right time is really the ideal, because that's how a person grows. And you have to, and the mitzvah that Hill says, you got to grow yourself. You got to grow. That's basically it. So I'd say the key two words is fierce learner. All right, guys. I'll see a number of you guys tomorrow at MJE. And I want to wish everybody a good night. Any questions?
I have a question.
Good.
Just to cover the basics and clarify what we were reading. So is the first section that had like the numbers of 18 and 23, is that actually from the Torah portion this week?
Yes, that's chapter 18, which is the parsha of Aera. It's from the first chapter of this week's parsha.
Okay, and then what does the Sforno refer to?
The Sforno is an Italian rabbi writing in the 1500s, and that's his short commentary on those verses.
Okay.
Good question.
So this was not a test of Avraham?
It's an interesting question. Is it a test? In other words, right. Question is he what he knows about? You could call it a test, because you're saying that he's confronted with a catastrophe. And what will he respond to? You know, will he be involved in a tefillah, a request for their survival?
Right. Is there, I mean, because he didn't really push back against God, right? I mean, that's not, I mean, it's.
Pushing back, he's pushing back to understand. In other words, once God says, this is an area which I'm inviting you to explore, he does not lose that opportunity. And he goes in strong.
Right. Okay.
I don't mean, obviously, if he says, you know, what God's, you know, he's not, you know, the idea we, that's God's justice, fine. But if you're going to have, if you're going to allow me a conversation to explore it, I'm going to take advantage of that.
Right.
Okay. You know, you're not going to miss that class. If God's, God's telling Abram, because you're the father of civilization, you're going to get the bonus track called, this is going down. This is in your neighborhood. Let's talk about that. And he allowed him to explore, and that, why doesn't the midas harachamim apply in this situation? Why doesn't the mercy apply not just for the righteous? Because you could really argue a simple say, if it's only midat hadin, strict justice, basically create an evacuation of the righteous and allow the wicked to be destroyed separately. But he's talking about, he knows that God's justice is always with the measure. There's also an aspect of God's kindness and mercy. So, with this, you know, mercy is not just a blank check. We're mercy parents when there's going to be an opportunity for growth. So these 50 guys can make a big difference. These 50 people, men or women, I don't know, we don't know, right?
So, okay. My understanding was that Avram went through like 10 tests.
The Pirkei Avos says he went through 10 tests. The only Torah, what test is mentioned overtly in the Torah of Avram?
The splitting of the parts.
No, that's not a test. That's a covenant. It's a brit.
Oh, yeah. That was a covenant. I'm sorry.
What is the only test?
The Akeda.
The Akeda. The Elohim Nisat Avram. God tested Abraham. So that's the only one. But that's the 10th one. Pirkei Avos identifies there 10. Now there's a debate between Rashi and the Ramban. What are those 10 trials?
Okay.
We got to look it up. Does anybody count, like you're saying, Mendel, that the experience of stone was a personal trial?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good question. In other words, he's being tested that, you know, what's going to be your response?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right, guys.
Thank you. Time. Thank you very much. Thank Have a good night.
Good night.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You got it.